Welcome back to the Fourth Way Podcast. For today's episode, I am going to read Martin Luther King Jr.'s Nonviolence and Racial Justice. And I wanted to read that today, or a work from King today, because today it was 56 years to the day that MLK was assassinated. So I thought this would be a special time to commemorate the life of Dr. King. I really wanted to read a different article from him. I wanted to read Beyond Vietnam, because I believe that was actually the sermon or the speech that he gave exactly a year prior to the day of his assassination. And I think that's a particularly powerful one, not only because of the timing of it and just the symbolism of it having been exactly a year before his assassination, but also because that speech really encapsulates why MLK was such a threat to the establishment, to the stupor that we are in here in the States. The article that I'm going to read today is great, and I think this talking about nonviolence and then bringing in racial justice is really important. And I think that a lot of times there are other sorts of injustices wrapped up into nonviolence. My conversation with Zach Johnson in our season on government, he talked a lot about how it's really the poor who end up suffering from violence. And a lot of our works in this season have talked about that and will talk about how the poor bear the brunt of violence. So that is really important to bring in racial justice. But King's Beyond Vietnam speech brought in so much more. Everybody seems to just kind of pigeonhole Dr. King into this guy who was on a mission for racial justice. And yeah, racial justice is important. And yes, that's a big part of what Dr. King was doing. But in that Beyond Vietnam speech, just a year before he died, King was talking about two other things that are also very big, which is poverty, which is bigger than the black community, right? Because you've got the black community and race, but then if you extend that to all of the poor, now that's a larger group. And then bringing in the Vietnam War, the military-industrial complex, and all that affects, like, that is also global. So King was stepping on quite a lot of toes there at the end. And to kind of save face and keep the fire from spreading, it was really beneficial to just kind of pigeonhole Dr. King as somebody who's just focused on racial injustice, because then we don't have to deal with the other major issues that King was dealing with, that he saw as huge systemic injustices. That being said, I was unable to obtain permission for that through Dr. King's estate. But this other article, Nonviolence and Racial Justice, it seems like it was held by a different publisher or rights holder. And so I was able to get in contact with the Quaker Press, and they gave me permission to use this article and reproduce it. So I'm going to read this one. It's great. But go out there and find King's Beyond. Again, I believe it's called Beyond Vietnam. And I will try to link that in the show notes as well. But it's fantastic. And then if you read that and you like that, go out and pick up the book or borrow from the library, get it on audiobook. It's a book called The Radical King, and you will not regret it. All right, let's dive into nonviolence and racial justice. It is commonly observed that the crisis in race relations dominates the arena of American life. This crisis has been precipitated by two factors: the determined resistance of reactionary elements in the South to the Supreme Court's momentous decision outlawing segregation in the public schools, and the radical change in the Negro's evaluation of himself. While Southern legislative halls ring with open defiance through interposition and nullification, while a modern version of the Ku Klux Klan has arisen in the form of respectable white citizens' councils, a revolutionary change has taken place in the Negro's conception of his own nature and destiny. Once he thought of himself as an inferior, and patiently accepted injustice and exploitation. Those days are gone. The first Negroes landed on the shores of this nation in 1619, 1 year ahead of the Pilgrim Fathers. They were brought here from Africa, and, unlike the Pilgrims, they were brought against their will, as slaves. Throughout the era of slavery, the Negro was treated in inhuman fashion. He was considered a thing to be used, not a person to be respected. He was merely a depersonalized cog in a vast plantation machine. The famous Dred Scott decision of 1857 well illustrates his status during slavery. In this decision, the Supreme Court of the United States said, in substance, that the Negro is not a citizen of the United States. He is merely property subject to the dictates of his owner. After his emancipation in 1863, the Negro still confronted oppression and inequality. It is true that for a time, while the army of occupation remained in the South and Reconstruction ruled, he had a brief period of eminence and political power, but he was quickly overwhelmed by the white majority. Then, in 1896, through the Plessy v. Ferguson decision, a new kind of slavery came into being. In this decision, the Supreme Court of the nation established the doctrine of separate but equal as the law of the land. Very soon it was discovered that the concrete result of this doctrine was strict enforcement of the separate, without the slightest intention to abide by the equal. So the Plessy doctrine ended up plunging the Negro into the abyss of exploitation where he experienced the bleakness of nagging injustice. A peace that was no peace. Living under these conditions, many Negroes lost faith in themselves. They came to feel that perhaps they were less than human. So long as the Negro maintained this subservient attitude and accepted the place assigned him, a sort of racial peace existed. But it was an uneasy peace, in which the Negro was forced patiently to submit to insult, injustice, and exploitation. It was a negative peace. True peace is not merely the absence of some negative force, tension, confusion, or war. It is the presence of some positive force, justice, goodwill, and brotherhood. Then circumstances made it necessary for the Negro to travel more. From the rural plantation, he migrated to the urban industrial community. His economic life began gradually to rise, his crippling illiteracy gradually to decline. A myriad of factors came together to cause the Negro to take a new look at himself. Individually and as a group, he began to reevaluate himself. And so he came to feel that he was somebody. His religion revealed to him that God loves all his children, and that the important thing about a man is not his specificity, but his fundamentum. Not the texture of his hair or the color of his skin, but the quality of his soul. This new self-respect and sense of dignity on the part of the Negro undermined the South's negative peace, since the white man refused to accept the change. The tension we are witnessing in race relations today can be explained in part by this revolutionary change in the Negro's evaluation of himself, and his determination to struggle and sacrifice until the walls of segregation have been finally crushed by the battering rams of justice. Quest for freedom everywhere. The determination of Negro Americans to win freedom from every form of oppression springs from the same profound longing for freedom that motivates oppressed peoples all over the world. The rhythmic beat of deep discontent in Africa and Asia is at bottom a quest for freedom and human dignity on the part of people who have long been victims of colonialism. The struggle for freedom on the part of oppressed people in general, and of the American Negro in particular, has developed slowly and is not going to end suddenly. Privileged groups rarely give up their privilege without strong resistance. But when oppressed people rise up against oppression, there is no stopping point short of full freedom. Realism compels us to admit that the struggle will continue until freedom is a reality for all the oppressed peoples of the world. Hence, the basic question which confronts the world's oppressed is, How is the struggle against the force of injustice to be waged? There are two possible answers. One is resort to the all-too-prevalent method of physical violence and corroding hatred. The danger of this method is its futility. Violence solves no social problems. It merely creates new and more complicated ones. Through the vistas of time, a voice still cries to every potential Peter, "Put up your sword!" The shores of history are white with the bleached bones of nations and communities that failed to follow this command. The American Negro and other victims of oppression succumb to the temptation of using violence in the struggle for justice. Unborn generations will live in a desolate night of bitterness, and their chief legacy will be an endless reign of chaos. Alternative to violence. The alternative to violence is nonviolent resistance. This method was made famous in our generation by Mahatma Gandhi, who used it to free India from the domination of the British Empire. 5 points can be made concerning nonviolence as a method in bringing about better racial conditions. First, this is not a method for cowards. It does resist. The nonviolent resistor is just as strongly opposed to the evil against which he protests as is the person who uses violence. His method is passive or non-aggressive in the sense that he is not physically aggressive towards his opponent, but his mind and emotions are always active, constantly seeking to persuade the opponent that he is mistaken. This method is passive physically, but strongly active spiritually. It is non-aggressive physically, but dynamically aggressive spiritually. A second point is that nonviolent resistance does not seek to defeat or humiliate the opponent, but to win his friendship and understanding. The nonviolent resistor must often express his protest through non-cooperation or boycotts, but he realizes that non-cooperation and boycotts are not ends themselves. They are merely means to awaken a sense of moral shame in the opponent. The end is redemption and reconciliation. The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community, while the aftermath of violence is tragic bitterness. A third characteristic of this method is that the attack is directed against forces of evil rather than against persons who are caught in those forces. It is evil we are seeking to defeat, not the persons victimized by evil. Those of us who struggle against racial injustice must come to see that the basic tension is not between races. As I like to say to the people of Montgomery, Alabama, the tension in this city is not between white people and Negro people. The tension is at bottom between justice and injustice, between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. And if there is a victory, it will be a victory not merely for 50,000 Negroes, but a victory for justice and the forces of light. We are out to defeat injustice, not white persons who may happen to be unjust. The fourth point that must be brought out concerning nonviolent resistance is that it avoids not only external physical violence, but also internal violence of the spirit. At the center of nonviolence stands the principle of love. In struggling for human dignity, the oppressed people of the world must not allow themselves to become bitter or indulge in hate campaigns. To retaliate with hate and bitterness would do nothing but intensify the hate in the world. Along the way of life, someone must have sense enough and morality enough to cut off the chain of hate. This can be done only by projecting the ethics of love to the center of our lives. The meaning of love. In speaking of love at this point, we are not referring to some sentimental emotion. It would be nonsense to urge men to love their oppressors in an affectionate sense. Love, in this connection, means understanding goodwill. There are three words for love in the Greek New Testament. First, there is eros. In Platonic philosophy, eros meant the yearning of the soul for the realm of the divine. It has come now to mean a sort of aesthetic or romantic love. Second, there is philia. It meant intimate affectionateness between friends. Philia denotes a sort of reciprocal love. The person loves because he is loved. When we speak of loving those who oppose us, we refer neither to eros nor philia. We speak of a love which is expressed in the Greek word agape. Agape means nothing sentimental or basically affectionate. It means understanding, redeeming goodwill for all men, an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. It is the love of God working in the lives of men. When we love on the agape level, we love men not because we like them, not because their attitudes and ways appeal to us, but because God loves them. Here we rise to the position of loving the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed he does. Finally, the method of nonviolence is based on the conviction that the universe is on the side of justice. It is this deep faith in the future that causes the nonviolent resistor to accept suffering without retaliation. He knows that in his struggle for justice, he has cosmic companionship. This belief that God is on the side of truth and justice comes down to us from the long tradition of our Christian faith. There is something at the very center of our faith which reminds us that Good Friday may reign for a day, but ultimately it must give way to the triumphant beat of the Easter drums. Evil may so shape events that Caesar will occupy a place and Christ a cross, but one day, that same Christ will rise up and split history into AD and BC, so that even the life of Caesar must be dated by his name. So in Montgomery we can walk and never get weary, because we know that there will be a great camp meeting in the promised land of freedom and justice. This, in brief, is the method of nonviolent resistance. It is a method that challenges all people struggling for justice and freedom. God grant that we wage the struggle with dignity and discipline. May all who suffer oppression in this world reject the self-defeating method of retaliatory violence and choose the method that seeks to redeem. Through using this method wisely and courageously, we will emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man in the bright daybreak of freedom and justice. King is always just such a fantastic writer and orator. It's almost as if there's hardly ever anything to say after he says what he has to say, because it's always so clear, and you're just almost left speechless at the end. But I do want to highlight just three things really quickly, and recommend that you go back and listen to how King says them, because they're way better. But I want to pull these out in case you're not as familiar with nonviolence and some of the themes that we find really important after a lot of discussion through the podcast. So first, I love how King talks about the difference between negative peace and positive peace. And this is something, you know, the word that we use, if you go back to Craig's season, I think season 10, maybe, but on peace, right, on shalom. Shalom, this idea that, there's restoration. If you have a war, like take the Civil War, and one side beats up the other side, just because the North won and had control didn't mean that there was peace. Right? King recognizes that in this negative peace, okay, one side has control, one side has power, but there's still this tension, this animosity that's built up, and really it's just waiting for an opportunity to be able to seize power and shift control the other way, and just it just kind of shifts this negative piece back and forth. It's really just the absence of active conflict. That's what negative peace is. Whereas positive peace is justice, goodwill, and brotherhood. And so I love how King points out that negative versus positive peace. And that goes into the second thing, which King points out, is that if you look at the effects of how nations have conducted themselves, how people tend to conduct themselves, they tend to seek violence because it's easier if you have the numbers, right? If you think that you cannot get the power, then you can overcome the enemy. And King talks about how that effect throughout time just has not paid off for nations and peoples. And we have modern research like that of, I think it's Erica Chenoweth, Why Non-Resistance Works or Why Nonviolence Works. She gets into more objective measures and looks at conflicts for the last half century and says, yeah, in fact, nonviolent resolutions end up being more effective by objective measures. And so that's something that evidence is beginning to show as people start to look into that. But King wasn't doing this because he thought it necessarily worked. I mean, he thinks it works because he believes, like Theodore Parker did, that this the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice, because he believes that a good, wise, powerful God created the world to work in harmony with good. And so if you do the good thing, it should lead towards better results. But King recognized that, whereas the people who want to wield violence say, well, yeah, I can get my results faster. King recognized that, okay, you might get them faster, more immediately with violence, but you're going to end up having a lot more problems in the long run. And really what is nonviolence will lead to longer term positive results, positive justice. And so King wasn't doing this for results. He recognized that doing the good thing should get you results over a longer period of time. But he did it because when he talks about the different kinds of loves, eros, philia, and agape, he says, look, the agape love is you're not doing it to get anything back. You're loving because that's what God does, right? These people are created in the image of God, and God loves them. I love them, not because I like them, not because they're going to get me anything. And because, and that's sort of the irony of this nonviolence here. We talk in some of the other episodes about how if you try to implement nonviolence as a strategy to get what you want, really you're still just trying to overpower somebody. You're trying to get control, and you're objectifying that other person. You're just manipulating them in a different way than through violence. And okay, maybe that's better. Maybe being nonviolent in an objectifying manner is better overall than being violent. But you know, King recognizes that that really there are different kinds of violences. There's not just the violence, physical violence, but there's violence of the spirit or violence of the soul. And people can tell when they're being objectified, and it is some sort of violence when you objectify somebody else. And so this relinquishing of a need for results and a need for reciprocity by King actually allows him to truly love the enemy. And it's only when you truly love the enemy, like deeply, not in an objectifying manner, that you are able to not seek their humiliation, that you are able to actually care about them, that you are able to seek their good. And when you do that, that's when you get the results of good, of nonviolence, because it's only then that you're actually doing the truly good thing by loving them. So there are all these ironies and complexities to this, but it's just an emptying of self. And an emptying of a need for immediate results and a just submission to God and his definition of love, which is agape, and in embracing that and enacting enemy love, nonviolence, that's what stirs the emotions, awakens the soul, and produces better long-term results. So, great work by King. Of course, still an issue going on today, racial injustice. But again, I'd recommend that you also check out his work Beyond Vietnam, as well as The Radical King, because that's going to give you a much broader picture of what King was fighting against. So, hope you enjoyed. That's all for now. So, peace, and because I'm a pacifist, when I say it, I mean it. This podcast is a part of the Kingdom Outpost Network. Please check out the links below to find other great podcasts and content related to nonviolence and kingdom living.